Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an update on the situation in Egypt on the third anniversary of the revolution that has since been quashed, with a return to military rule that has been going on in Egypt since 1952. Sama Shahata, a professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, joins us to discuss what kind of support there is for the military who have successfully divided the liberals and Islamists and conquered the hope for democracy that was manifested in Tahrir Square 3 years ago. Then, ahead of the State of the Union address, we will look into President Obama's promise to work with Congress where he can and his threat to bypass Congress in 2014 where he can't, promising, "We're not just going to be waiting for legislation in order to make sure we are providing Americans with the kind of help they need. I've got a pen and I've got a phone." Keith Poole, chair of the Department of Political Science in the School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia and author of Political Bubbles, Financial Crises, and the Failure of American Democracy, joins us to discuss what the president can do to circumvent an implacably hostile Congress. Then finally, we'll speak with Sister Simone Campbell, the executive director of NETWORK, a Catholic social justice lobby. We will discuss growing income and wealth disparity in the U.S. and the world, which the president is supposed to mention in his upcoming State of the Union, and look into what can be done to restore social justice and economic opportunity in a world where just 85 individuals have wealth equal to the combined wealth of 3.5 billion people, half of the world's population. And joining us now is Sama Shahata, who's an associate professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma and formerly a professor at Georgetown's University Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. He's the author of Shop Floor Culture and Politics in Egypt. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sama Shahata.
Thanks for having me back.
And on this third anniversary of the 2011 revolution in Egypt that overthrew President Hosni Mubarak, and a military regime, in effect, that's been running the country since 1952. About 50 people have been killed in clashes today over the last couple of days. And now, of course, they're talking about new elections, and it looks as if they would be elections that would produce Sisi, the current military leader, as the new leader. And there's apparently a tremendous amount of lobbying underway to make General Fatah al-Sisi the new president. Is that your understanding?
Well, he's certainly incredibly popular. He's the Minister of Defense, and I think he also holds the title of Minister of Military Production and Deputy Prime Minister. So many titles. And he, of course, is the one who was responsible for, after millions of people protested at the end of June, last year, ousting democratically elected first civilian president Mohamed Morsi. So yes, there is a great deal of lobbying. That's correct. There are campaigns, popular campaigns, to get him to announce his presidential run, and he is very popular. But as you mentioned, and as is known, he hails from the military. He is the individual who ousted President Morsi, and of course, one wonders what the outcome would be for Egypt and Egyptian democracy if he were to run.
So what happened to the liberals who were the original proponents of the original revolution 3 years ago? They are all but absent. Have they been driven into the shadows?
Say three things, and in order to understand what's been going on in Egypt, I think, properly. The first thing is that, and I've been saying this, and I think many have for quite some time, is that there wasn't a revolution in Egypt in 2011. Millions of people protested. It was incredibly energetic and a wonderful spectacle and, you know, an incredible triumph of the will to have millions of people have sustained protests against an authoritarian regime for 18 days that eventually led to the removal of the head of that regime, Hosni Mubarak. And in fact, it was the military, really, at the end, who pushed him aside, pushed him under the bus to save themselves and to save the regime. And why that's an important distinction is because it wasn't a revolution. They didn't uproot the entire authoritarian infrastructure and institutions that were part of that oppressive regime. They left many of them largely or wholly in place, like the military, like the security services, like the intelligence, like much of the judiciary and so on. And that partially explains the resistance to democracy that we've seen over the last 3 years that have made real democracy, freedom, human rights, rule of law, security sector reform, transitional justice, almost impossible. That's the first point. The second point is, to your question, where have the liberals gone? Well, I think the liberals have gone in two or three places. As you probably know, some of them are in jail now. Some of the youth activists who were really the ones responsible for the uprising in 2011, Ahmed Meher of the April 6th movement, Ahmed Duma, also a blogger and critic and activist and so on, they're now in jail. They've been put in jail over the last few months, charged with violating the new protest law. We like to call it the anti-protest law because it puts so many restrictions on protest that the new government has put in place. So that's, and many others also, some journalists and so on, have been either intimidated or essentially silenced. So that's part of the liberals. And the other part, and this has always been Egypt's dilemma, are either silent or supporting the government now, not because they necessarily are fully happy with it, but because they fear the Islamists. And I like to say that they fear the Islamists more than they like or love democracy and liberalism, right? And that's the dilemma. And so that's really the state of the liberals, and some people say kind of, you know, pseudo-liberals or liberals in quotation marks of in Egypt.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Sama Shahata, who is a Associate Professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma and formerly a professor at Georgetown University's Center for Contemporary Arab Studies, and he's the author of Shop Floor Culture and Politics in Egypt. So on this third anniversary of the Egyptian uprising, if we can't call it a revolution, just this month, Egyptian voters ratified a new constitution that essentially gives the military, the police, and the intelligence unprecedented power, and they've always been in power. So they've been given a blank check. So when we talk about voters and referenda, I mean, what are the numbers? I mean, there obviously is support for the military, but how can you quantify it?
Well, this is, and you've, again, hit on the right thing. I mean, it is a complicated, not black and white story. And the numbers are the following, you know. 20 million people voted in the referendum for the Constitution on January 14th and 15th. That comes out to about a 38% turnout for registered voters. And of the people who voted, about 97-98% voted yes for the Constitution. Now, to understand the story, of course, you have to remember that the Muslim Brotherhood and others called for a boycott, so they didn't go out even to voice their opinion. And then those who tried to campaign, the few who tried to campaign against the referendum on very legitimate grounds and not necessarily supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood, were either silenced and some of them were actually jailed just for campaigning for a no vote. Now, that being said, the civilian military-backed civilian government that's in power now and Minister Sisi are genuinely popular. They're genuinely popular because many Egyptians supported, not all, but many Egyptians supported the ouster of Morsi. The economic situation had deteriorated significantly. There were regular electricity shortages. There were fuel shortages. People had to wait in line for 5 or 6 hours at the gas pump to get gasoline and diesel fuel and so on. And over the spring and summer months, there were regular power outages across the country. The economy had deteriorated. There was a shortage of foreign currency. You couldn't get dollars and so on. Much of this, of course, was produced by elements of the regime precisely to see the demise of Morsi and see people get angry at the current regime. But nevertheless, all of that is a way to say that there is a great deal of support for the current government. Now, of course, there are some huge numbers also of people who are the victims of the current government, but that's the state of Egypt as it is today.
Well, of course, there is this movie, and I know the filmmakers, and it's up for the Academy Award, The Square. and it's banned in Egypt, but apparently it's going to be shown on a jumbotron in Tahrir Square. At least that's my understanding. And it would seem that the U.S. not only, I think, is a news story, it's almost as if we've forgotten about it, but it also appears to me that our government is somewhat lost. They seem to, you know, don't know what to do. Chuck Hagel tries to talk with Sisi, and I don't think he's getting anywhere. And the impression I get is that, and by the way, the Egyptian military regime, through its, you know, control of the press, seem to be just vilifying the U.S. around the clock. Is that your understanding?
Well, yes, there is a great deal of hostility towards not just the American press and so on, but the foreign press and foreign coverage of the situation, because many in Egypt, of course, those supporters of the current government, see critical stories largely in the Western press, and they say, look, you know, you're only reporting on half the picture, or you're reporting a biased perspective. I mean, you're not reporting on the supporters of the current situation. But in any case, you are correct that the United States finds itself in a difficult position, is also acting, I think, inappropriately, and has had inappropriate policies for the last 6, 7, 8 months now with regard to the change of power. I mean, there has been, and to be fair, you know, they don't know what to do, and they have limited effect as well. In other words, they can't kind of control the outcome. But I don't think they've been critical enough, certainly, with the governments in Egypt. They're continuing to supply them economic and military assistance, and their criticism has been muted. And in fact, at times, Secretary Kerry seemed to have indicated that they were making progress on democracy, which is not the case at all, really. So that's the position the United States has been in. It has not really called for an end to military assistance. It has not been harsher in its criticism of the abuses that have taken place and so on.
Well, it seems to me that the real backers, in terms of foreign backers of the Egyptian counter-revolution with the military takeover, have been the Saudis. As soon as the coup took place, the military coup took place, the money poured in from Saudi Arabia. My understanding is that the Saudis also, through their connections with the military, were complicit in all of these shortages of gasoline and diesel that you mentioned earlier, and long lines for food, etc. So is there a shift underway? Because I know that when back in the original revolution or uprising, apparently the Saudi king was on the phone every day to Obama, screaming at him, saying, let Mubarak shoot those kids and squash this revolution. And Obama refused. And so it's pretty clear what the Saudi position is. So is Saudi Arabia now like a big player in this? And by extension, the military regime now put out feelers to Russia. Maybe they'll buy arms from Russia. What's going on there?
Yes, I mean, this is certainly a regional issue. There's no question about that. And from the very beginnings of the Arab uprisings, there were countries in the region who were vehemently against the idea of democracy or holding leaders accountable to the populations and so on. And those countries were the authoritarian states in the region, but particularly in the Gulf, Saudi Arabia, some of the other Gulf states, the United Arab Emirates. And, you know, you didn't mention Kuwait, and of course it's an interesting country because there's a significant degree of democratic participation in Kuwait, but the ruling family and the regime itself is against democracy flourishing elsewhere in the region. And so Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Kuwait poured in billions of dollars to the tune of $12 billion initially after the ouster of Morsi took place. And several of those countries have committed and given more money to Egypt since. The United Arab Emirates, for example, several billion more dollars. And they are fully supportive of the current regime in Egypt and are opposed to, you know, democracy sweeping over the region, crossing over the Red Sea, and threatening their own regimes. So, yes, there's no question that I think one has to look at the Arab region regionally and see those countries that have been opposed to the development of democracy, and then, you know, maybe the few that have tried to support it. I mean, Tunisia mildly so, and so on.
So, Sami Shahada, do you think that this film, The Square, up for the Academy Awards, and it's likely it might win the Academy Award, it certainly is a powerful piece of work. It tells the whole story of the revolution going back 3 years up to the present. And for all of Morsi and the military's claim that they do not want to harm a single Egyptian, the film makes it clear that that has not been the case, that there have been brutal beatings. And we've seen them shoot people down in the streets, too, at the time of the coup against Morsi. So what's your sense, then, of whether a movie or a documentary feature can make a difference here? Or, in other words, it's as though they are fulfilling their own kind of worst nightmare here, the idea that the Muslim Brotherhood is a part of this Islamist interpretation of democracy, which is one person, one vote, one time. Once they get in, then it's the end of democracy. And it's almost as though they have created their own nemesis here and preempted.
Well, they haven't fully allowed that to take place, right? I mean, you're right that they, you know, that the boogeyman of Islamist politics and takeover and so on has then, you know, subverted the possibility of democracy. And to be fair, you know, the Morsi government was miserable, and Morsi made tremendous mistakes, and there were some authoritarian tendencies and so on. And the constitution that was passed was not a constitution for all Egyptians. It was written by an Islamist-dominated constituent assembly, and it was not really, you know, a pinnacle of democracy and equality for all and so on. With regard to the question, I don't think, unfortunately, and I'm, you know, pessimistic about this, that a film, particularly a kind of foreign-made film, you know, is going to have a huge impact or going to change the course of history in Egypt. I think that it's gotten some attention. You know, it's been in the papers in Egypt, and in fact, it's been in the papers in the Arabic press in Egypt as a film about Egypt that's nominated for this major award that can't be screened in Egypt, right? Mm-hmm. And so on. And I think liberals and intellectuals and so on and activists are going to enthusiastically go out and try to watch the movie. And if it does get screened in Tahrir, there will be people there to watch it and so on. But I don't think it's going to change the course of history in any way inside Egypt.
But the filmmakers are Egyptian, are they not, or Egyptian-American?
I think one of them is, yeah, but the movie isn't, you know, a movie, I think, initially geared for a domestic Egyptian audience. I think it was, which isn't the criticism of the movie. I mean, you know, but nevertheless, I don't think that any film really could have that kind of an impact. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking about here, and I think people forget this, vested political and economic interests of major institutions, and you know, this is quite serious. We're talking about the military, we're talking about military generals, the security establishment, the police, the intelligence, the elements of what we call the deep state in Egypt, really, aren't necessarily elected officials. Not all of them are in the public view, but they were part of and are part of an autocratic system. And they certainly are going to fight. And this is, I think, what people were somewhat naive about when the uprising apparently succeeded with the removal of Mubarak. You know, the beneficiaries of the previous order were not going to sit back and you know, recede into the sunset, right? I mean, they have vested interests at stake, and they've been fighting ever since, and the struggle continues.
And, of course, to some extent, it was the Egyptian military behind the scenes that manipulated those first elections to, you know, to come out with this result of Morsi being the leader and being, the, you know, one of the least effective of the others, you know. And the-
well, I don't think that they manipulated the election results. And remember, the election took place in two stages. In the first round, there were, you know, 12 or so candidates. We didn't really know who were going to be the top two. In fact, all of the polling data got it wrong. People thought that Amr Moussa, the former foreign minister and secretary general of the Arab League, was going to be the front runner. But in fact, and unfortunately for Egyptians, the two most polarizing figures, the two most extreme figures, Morsi from the Muslim Brotherhood and Ahmed Shafiq, Mr. Mubarak's last prime minister, formerly the head of the Air Force, an element of that regime, emerged.
Well, that was my point. That was my point, that, you know, that the more intelligent and moderate Muslim Brotherhood leader didn't make it, and the socialist leader didn't make it, and they came close. And it seemed
you're right, they did come close. And but I think that it was really kind of, you know, just an accident of history, and had to do also with the kind of political structures that existed in Egypt. But you are definitely right that from the moment that Morsi became president and so on, there were many who wanted to see his demise and actively worked for it. I mean, I remember a trip to Egypt, you know, before the ouster in March of 2012, and having been in Egypt for a couple of weeks and meeting people and so on, I was convinced that the so-called liberal and secular opposition were hoping for economic collapse as a way to get rid of Morsi. I mean, it was incredible. Rather than working towards, you know, the possibility of winning in parliamentary elections or something like that, or establishing a grassroots, they were betting on economic collapse and food shortages and so on as a way to get rid of this president. And so, you know, that clearly is not something that's going to deepen democracy and democratic consolidation and the culture of democracy and so on in a place. So,
well, Sami Shahada, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're very welcome.
Again, I'm speaking with Sami Shahada, who's an associate professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma and formerly a professor at Georgetown University Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. He's the author of Shop Floor Culture and Politics in Egypt. And we're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about whether in the State of the Union the president is going to threaten to bypass the Congress.